Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
Another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew. Yeah.
Sorry, one second. I'm not Jeffrey Craig. I'm Jeffrey Keller Craig.
Yes. And I'm Matthew Craig.
And we are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
This is our podcast where we talk about board games. Yeah, got thrown off a little bit because it's been a while. And a lot has happened since we went on our hiatus. We didn't know exactly how long it was going to be. Turns out it was a little bit longer than we anticipated, but we are back now. As you may be able to guess from our intro, I got married.
And yay, congrats, claps.
Currently in the process of getting a house, so yeah, things are pretty wild, but we are back. We're going to try publishing monthly episodes like before, maybe slightly more often than that. We'll see, but our hiatus is now over, and we are here today to discuss a board game.
Yes.
Like we usually do. So, back to the tried and true form. Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Return to Dark Tower. So, the original game was released in 1981 and designed by Roger Burton, Alan Coleman, Vincent A., and A.J. Arado. And today, however, we are talking about the remake, published in 2022 by Restoration Games and designed by a whole team there, including Tim Burrell Saward, Isaac Childress, Noah Cohen, Rob Davio, Justin D. Jacobson, and Brian Neff.
All right.
And you might recognize one of those names, Rob Davio, because we actually interviewed him about a year and a half ago or so, and he had come on to promote this game.
Yep. That was when the game was just about to launch on Kickstarter, and I personally backed it, and we have played it a bunch since it has shipped, and it's very great. I highly recommend listeners to check out that previous episode. That interview ended up turning out really good, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're talking about Return to Dark Tower. So just like always, we're going to give a short description on what the game is like. We're going to talk about how to play it and the strategies that we've come up with while playing it. And then we're going to talk about the design later on. So for the short description on what Return to Dark Tower is about, in Return to Dark Tower, players are a team of heroes from the Four Kingdoms who have united to defeat a powerful foe who threatens the kingdoms from within the central Dark Tower. Over the course of five, quote, months, players take turns clearing blight, fighting monsters, collecting loot, strengthening their forces, and completing quests, all in an effort to draw the big bad monster out of the tower and slay it. All right, so that's a short description. Now, technically, this is the second time we've tried to record this. The first time, we went into way too much detail talking about how to play it. So we are going to give a sort of condensed version, a little more less detailed than what we usually do when we're discussing how to play a game. But that's just in the interest of time, because this game is pretty complicated.
Yeah, I feel like there's one good starting point, though, when talking about how to play.
Sure.
Which is that this game has an app that you use during the game. It is controlled by an app, if you will.
Yes. So, yeah, they developed an app to run the game, and it connects via Bluetooth to the tower, which we'll talk about after this. But you could think of the app just sort of like as a replacement for about like 6 or 7 decks of cards in this game. Well, maybe more than that. 6 or 7 decks of cards per game, but there's dozens of decks that would be used for like controlling the monsters and all their different attacks. So the app just sort of like is a replacement for all these decks of cards. It keeps the board and the table top simple, and it provides that randomness that is sort of bespoke to each different monster and scenario that a deck of cards could have accomplished, or multiple decks of cards.
Yeah.
It controls how many turns are in the game. It controls the events that happen at the end of every turn. It is what you use to participate in combat against the monsters and also explore dungeons. And like I said, it pairs with the tower. So next, let's talk about the tower.
Yes. It is this big plastic tower that sits in the very center of the board. It is divided into 4 sides, sort of. And each side has 3 sort of column or 3 rows to it. You can think of it like 3 squares lined up one above the other. And then at the very top is this sort of like a pit, like a little bowl with a circle in the middle.
An opening, if you will.
Yeah. At the end of a player's turn, they drop a little skull token into the top of the tower, and that tells the app that it is the end of that turn. That's when it goes through all the end of turn effects or between turn effects. And also, these skulls can sometimes fall out the bottom of the tower or one of the side pockets of the tower to cause havoc on the board beneath them.
Yeah, these skulls are the blight that I mentioned in the short description. When they exit the tower from one of the four faces, then whichever kingdom that face of the tower is facing, its skull goes on one of the four buildings in that kingdom. And when a building accumulates too many skulls, it is destroyed, and the player responsible for that kingdom takes... what is it called? Oh, no, is that called Blight? Now I gotta go grab the game real quick. And when a building accumulates too many skulls or Blight, then it is destroyed, and the player who's responsible for controlling the kingdom that that building was in acquires a corruption. And the corruption are one of the few lose conditions for the players. By the way, did we mention this is a cooperative game?
Yes.
I sort of mentioned it in the short description. But yes, this is a cooperative game.
Yes, players work together, though each player starts in their own kingdom that they are then responsible for, and each player also has their own sort of character class.
So let's talk a little bit more about what each player does and who they are in this game.
Sure.
So, you are a hero, and you have two primary resources, which are warriors and spirit. The warriors are your combat resource. You lose them in combat or sometimes gain them in combat. And then your spirit is more like a traditional resource, like a money or currency, rather, that you spend to level your character up and acquire items.
Yeah.
So on a given player's turn, they take three actions in any order. Those actions are a move action, which is just moving a certain distance around the board, up to a certain distance. There is the heroic action, which is how you fight monsters and complete quests and also remove blight from buildings. So you take one heroic action of those. And then the last is a reinforce action, which is an action you can only take when you're on the same space as a building. And that action's effect is determined by which type of building you are standing next to.
Mm-hmm. And there are four buildings.
Right. And that those buildings could give you more spirit. They could give you potions. They could give you warriors. And they can give you items, depending on the building. And then each of these reinforced actions has like a bonus effect. You can spend spirit to get extra stuff, like extra warriors, for example. So yeah, you take turns taking these actions all around the board, moving, doing quests. The quests are provided by the app, and the quests will have rewards sometimes, like special quest items or allies that give you special bonuses, which are very powerful. And then combat. We mentioned combat earlier, but to put it briefly, each monster or foe has a deck, and when it's your turn, you draw a number of cards based on the monster's level. You always have a level 2, 3, and 4 monster. And so for the level 4 monster, for example, you draw 4 cards from that deck. This is all on the app. And then each card you draw has an effect on it. And those effects are generally negative, but you can lessen the effect of a card by spending a resource called advantage, which is something that you calculate as soon as you enter battle. It comes from your items and your character. And you spend advantage to reduce the effects of the cards from the monster's combat. And if you reduce an effect far enough, it could end up being a benefit to you. Like, for example, a card might say lose 6 warriors. Maybe you spend 1 advantage, it becomes lose 3 warriors. Spend a couple more advantage, and it becomes gain 3 warriors. Let's see, is there anything else important that we should mention? I guess I should also mention what the big bad is.
Yeah.
And how that's determined and what that means in a game.
Mm-hmm.
So at the beginning of the game, the app, you use the app to set things up. You get to select the monsters that you want to fight, or you can choose them at random. One of those monsters is the big, bad, evil boss monster that is waiting inside the tower. That monster will have a special quest that you must complete in order to draw it out of the tower. And then once it does, you fight it. And technically, the boss monster is a level 5 monster, so you always draw 5 cards when you fight it.
And you mentioned that they do periodic effects throughout the game.
Not really. But yeah, those are sort of what the events are that happen at the end of turns. The events will usually involve removing doors from the tower, which could make more skulls spill out, or reveal seals that provide negative effects to whoever that door was facing. It could involve spawning monsters or having those monsters attack you. And then it could also involve the monster unleashing some sort of attack from within the tower. So like, for example, there's a attack, or there's a monster called the Ash Beast or something like that. It's like a fire themed monster, and it lights the rivers on fire that separate the kingdoms on the board. So that's a bad thing. And periodically the rivers will catch fire, and that means that you take damage if you try and cross them.
I wanted to bring up just one quick thing about the differences between characters.
Okay.
So every character has a banner action, which is a free action you can do that's different for each character. These can be getting free resources or moving around the board differently. When you said you can level up your character, I want to quickly clarify what that actually is. Every character has these things called virtues, which are these sort of like rectangular tokens that have a bonus on them. You always start with 3 face up by default, including 1 based on what kingdom you're playing in. But then also throughout the game, you can spend spirit to flip over the other virtues and gain those benefits.
All right. So that's the gist, the boiled down version of how to play the game. So now let's get into the strategies that we have observed from playing this game.
Yeah.
So the first one being, when you first set up the game and play it for the first time, you might find combat to be a little daunting, because going into combat, you don't know exactly what kinds of resources you'll need in order to defeat a monster, like how many warriors or spirit you're going to need. And you don't necessarily realize how strong the advantages are. And so it kind of feels like going into combat, you're going to come out the other side with less than you went in. However, if you have enough advantages, and this is something that you can pretty easily calculate, every combat will like guaranteed give you resources after you beat it, including the 2 spirit, which you gain after completing a heroic action. So the first piece of strategic advice I have is that early game, like on your first couple of turns, you should try to acquire as many relevant advantages as you can. Each monster and dungeon requires, or only allows you to spend specific types of advantages in them or against them. So acquire a couple proper advantages and then go into the combat, and you'll end up gaining more than you spent. This gives you more resources than if you were just cleansing or questing on your turn for your heroic action.
Yeah.
It also removes a monster from the board, which is a good thing, because that means there's less chances for an event to happen at the end of a turn where the monsters attack.
Yeah. On our first playthrough, we kind of underestimated how much damage the monsters would actually do. I think there's especially some that will just like add a corruption to a player, whether by destroying a building or through other means. And those are just like completely backbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually the one thing we didn't do was we didn't really read the cards that you take out of the box to show some information about the enemies, because the cards will give a short description about what those enemies' general strategies and penalties will be against the players. And so if we had read that, we would have seen like, oh, these enemies, they tend to add skulls to buildings, and this specific enemy likes to just straight up destroy buildings, so very dangerous if it appears. Read those cards for sure, and then go in with ample advantages. Well, maybe not ample, but so just to explain how many advantages you really need for a monster, a monster will have a like threat level assigned to it at the beginning of the game, and then periodically those threat levels will go up to a maximum of 5 But when at the start of the game, monsters have a threat level of 3, this just means that on their cards that you draw during combat, they have like 3 levels of intensity to them. And you spend disadvantages to reduce that level. And if you spend 2 advantages on a threat level 3 monster, that means that it'll go down to level 1 on the card. And that's usually when you gain resources rather than lose resources. So if you're fighting a level 2 monster at threat level 3, that means you just need 4 advantages, and both cards that you draw will be reduced to the absolute minimum, and you're guaranteed to get resources from that.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually like fairly easy to do in the first turn, I feel like.
Yeah. If you just visit a bazaar and spend spirit to buy an artifact, then you can usually buy like that artifact plus the basic item that corresponds to a monster that basically gives you 3 advantage. And then if you fight that monster on a specific kind of territory, or your player class is particularly good at fighting that monster, you have 4 on the first turn.
Yeah.
There's a couple artifacts that have instant kill effects that lets you just straight up remove an enemy from the board for some sort of cost. These are really strong for the late game when the like level 4 monsters start to appear. They're super dangerous, and you really should get rid of them as fast as you can. And doing so without even having to fight them is really strong.
Yeah. I do want to mention that you don't really have to cleanse skulls early anyways. So yes. Skulls only matter if a single building has 4 or more. So you can always spread them out a bit while they fall into the kingdom. Whoever's kingdom they fall into, they can choose where to put them on those buildings. However, additionally, if you like run out of monsters in play, skulls are the other main way to get spirit from that that like quest action.
Yeah, the heroic action.
The heroic action, yeah.
It should be mentioned that there is a limited supply of skulls to every game, and you take from that supply and drop into the tower every turn. If that supply ever runs empty, everyone loses the game. That's one of the other lose conditions, is if you run out of skulls. So while it is okay to just let them accumulate, you know, throughout the game, as long as, you know, every building in a territory doesn't have 3 skulls on it, you do need to keep a close look on that supply. And if it does start to run low, 1 or 2 of the players playing the game should probably perform a cleanse action just to restock that supply.
Yeah. So this game has trading between players.
Yes.
And
you basically trade almost anything.
Yeah.
The only thing you can't trade are corruptions and virtues. I think everything else is tradable.
Yeah. Except for like items that you can't hold more than one of. Those, sure. If they already have one, you can't give them a second. But like trading is super important. One of the main things is that you can kind of duplicate items this way. So, like, if I buy an item that has a stealth advantage, I can fight a stealth monster, then give it to Jeffrey, and then he can use that same thing on his turn. So you're getting the most value out of items if you're able to share them.
Mm-hmm.
By essentially just, you know, spreading how many people can use the advantages.
This also kind of ties into my next strategy point, where, like, yeah, you can trade items and advantages and stuff like that with other players, and that's really good because it's very strong in this game when players specialize in specific types of advantages or specific like tasks or kinds of items in this game. So rather than like make sure everybody has a little bit of this advantage and a little bit of that advantage, it's better to just like get one type of advantage piled onto one person, and that makes them really good at fighting specific kinds of enemies. And then it's their job to take care of those enemies as they spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And then if somebody's good at like mobility and getting around the map, then don't compete with them for mobility effects and stuff. Just pile it onto them, and now they can go anywhere they want and be anywhere they need to be. Specializing in this game is very good, and not trying to compete with your allies with like what you do is very good in this game.
Right. I feel like it's not too hard to move around the map in general. Like, one of the basic items you can get is a boot that gives you, what, like a +2 to your base movement?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can still double your movement after that.
Yeah, any player can spend one spirit on their turn to double their movement.
Yeah, and you can also break your movement up between actions. You can, like, visit a place, reinforce, and then visit to a monster and attack it.
Right.
So, like, because of all that, I feel like specializing is even better because you don't have to worry about really, like, missing your opportunity. It really shouldn't take you more than 2 turns to get to where you need to be.
Sure. And just because one player, you know, maybe if you can't get there in one turn, that doesn't mean that it's not hard to, like, also have a little bit of effectiveness yourself at something that somebody else is really good at doing. But I think I'm just saying that, like, if you can trade some stuff to somebody and make them even better at the thing that they do well, that's a really good thing.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk really quick about the 2 most powerful characters in the base game.
Mm-hmm.
So the game comes with 4 characters, and 2 of them, they have different colors. There's the blue character, the green character, the white character, and the red character. I can't remember exactly what their classes are. There's, like, the Orphan Scion, I think, is one of them. The Brutal Warlord is another one. But the blue and white characters are the strongest characters in the game, from my experience.
Yeah.
And if you're playing, like, just a 2-player game, I think you'll have a really easy time if either player is playing one of these 2 characters. And to explain why, the white character has a base movement of 4. The other characters only have a base movement of 3. So they immediately start the game with more movement than any other character. If they acquire boots, then they have a movement of 5. But I think with a movement of 5, if you double your movement, you can go from any space on the board to any other space on your board, on the board. So 10 movement is enough to get around, but their banner action allows them to, at the start of their turn, teleport to anywhere in the kingdom that they started their turn in. So if you started your turn in one kingdom, but all the way on one side, you can immediately teleport to the other side before you begin your turn and take your move actions. So the white character can be anywhere on the board at all times, which is very powerful because the quests and objectives in this game appear on specific parts of the board, and you need to travel to them in order to complete them. So having someone that on any given turn can be wherever they need to be, super good.
Yeah.
And then I'll let you talk about the blue character, because that's the one that you played in our first game.
Yeah.
And they are very strong.
So the blue character is the Relic Hunter. Yes. And the Relic Hunter's banner action at the start of their turn is to gain 1 potion. And potions are one-time use cards that have random effects, but they're usually equal or slightly above rate than other effects of the same type. But at the same time, you get a lot of flexibility because you can use as many potions as you want per turn.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one that just gives you a wild advantage, meaning you can use it on anything. There's one that gives you warrior tokens. There's one that, you know, removes skulls in a building, but you can play all of those effects on the same turn, so if you don't need your potion the turn you get it, you can just save it for pretty much whenever. And right. They can be traded to other players. Mm-hmm. So if you're, like, stacking up advantages on one player, then you can just give them the potions you got. Not to mention that, the Relic Hunter's sort of starting virtue is that they spend less spirit to gain treasures. So they can also stack up on treasures really quickly, which, again, means that they can get, you know, more advantages quicker and fight monsters quicker. It also means that if there are any treasures you need for a quest, they're very good at getting those. And I feel like having a quick way to deal with quests is actually a really big deal. All their virtues are good, by the way.
Yes.
Like, double the number on the potion is huge.
That's the best virtue in the game, is mm-hmm. the one that doubles potions, because doubling is really strong. Changing 7 warriors to 14 warriors, changing 1 wild advantage to 2 wild advantage, changing I think it's 2 spirit you get from a potion to 4 spirit.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And like, yeah, so the Spy Master has tons of flexibility. They usually acquire spirit faster, or they acquire spirit faster because they don't spend as much spirit on treasure. And they can occasionally get the potions that give them spirit, which allows them to unlock their virtues faster, which unlocks the double spirit or the double potion. They're just really strong. They get tons of resources through their banner and their virtues.
Mm-hmm.
The Spy Master, by the way, that was the white character, is called the Spy Master.
Yeah.
So yeah, the Spy Master and the Relic Hunter are the strongest classes from my experience. The other ones, the Brutal Warlord, their banner is to get warriors, and they get their virtues involve like losing combat, and they like soften the blows from losing combat, or they give you some like special bonuses if you lose combat by a little bit or lose warriors, which, you know, I'd rather just not lose warriors.
I do like the warlord getting an extra wild advantage though.
Yeah,
whenever they battle.
Yes, getting a wild advantage is pretty nice.
And usually in games where we've had the warlord, they've been the one to end the game just because they have a ton of warriors to fight the like main boss.
Sure.
And just they can trade the warriors they get, so they can always funnel those resources into other players better.
Right. The warlord is nice to have, but definitely not the strongest. And then the Orphan Scion is all about spirit, and they gain spirit as their banner, and they're also sort of about cleansing skulls.
Yeah, that's the thing, is they're not really about spirit.
Yeah.
They gain a spirit from their banner, but like 2 of their virtues involve cleansing. One of them involves having no skulls adjacent to your space,
mm-hmm.
which is cleansing adjacent. And then the last one is that you can spend spirit to prevent warrior losses. But like, I think the problem with the Orphan Scion is just that like having 1 extra spirit per turn usually ends up just meaning you can like buy a treasure every turn.
Right. Which the Relic Hunter can do, but better.
Yeah. They're every other turn. Because unless you do the heroic action, you would only get that 1 spirit. Yeah, it's they seem kind of redundant and aren't super great by themselves.
But I think this game is somewhat easy, at least on your like second playthrough of the game. On our first playthrough, we made a couple key mistakes, but we still ended up with a victory.
Well,
we technically, I think, made a misjudgment because of a communication error, which technically would have lost us the game, but
yeah,
we wanted to win on our first playthrough, so we kind of retconned it.
We're dirty cheaters. Forgive us.
But anyways, every subsequent game we haven't cheated and we've won. So making it a little more difficult by using characters that are less strong could be something you could play around with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's one more strategy thing I want to talk about is that every month, which every month is like a number of turns, and like I said, there's 5 months to a game. At the end of the 5th month, if you haven't beaten the big bad monster, then you lose the game. That's another one of the lose conditions, is not completing the game by the end of the 5th month. Months have a random amount of turns that the app determines and doesn't tell you. But at the beginning of every month, 2 quests are revealed. There is the ally quest and the monthly boss quest, I guess you can call it. These are different from the main quest, when you complete the main quest, then the monster leaves the tower so that you can fight it. The monthly quests are pretty good to complete. The ally quest is way more important than the other monthly quest. So the other monthly quest, usually there's like a threat that something bad will happen if you don't complete it. And if you do complete it, nothing happens at the end of the month. If you don't, something bad happens. Maybe a building gets destroyed or everyone gets a corruption or something like that. Maybe everyone has to discard a treasure, whatever. Preventing something bad from happening is okay. But the ally quests are way better because when you complete them, oftentimes you gain an ally, which an ally functions a little bit like an item. They can give you special actions or they can give you advantages. But the other thing that an ally does that isn't written on the card itself is that if you acquire an ally, then at the end of every turn, when events are happening, the ally has a chance of performing their own event. And in some cases, this can prevent bad events from happening. So like there's one ally who's like a hunter. And if you acquire them, then at the end of every month, sometimes a monster would have spawned, but because you have that ally, they prevent that monster from spawning. So making more good events happen at the end of every turn is a very good thing. So always complete the ally quest for that. And then after the ally quest is completed, complete the monster quest. I guess I do have one more strategy point, and that's you should try to finish the game in like the fourth or fifth month.
In the fifth month.
Well, yeah, but I'm also saying is don't try to finish the game in month two or three. Like, it's possible that you might be able to complete the main quest really early and spawn the boss really early. And that's not a good thing, because when you spawn the boss, when the boss comes out of the tower, the events that happen at the end of every turn, the bad stuff, it like ramps up when the boss is on the map. So it's important not to spawn him too soon, because if you do, then the boss is going to be on the board for a while and a ton of those bad events are going to happen. If they're in the tower, then those events happen less frequently, and that gives you more safety and more wiggle room to just like build up resources and get ready for that ultimate fight. So don't spawn the boss too soon. Wait until like month four, then coax him out of the tower.
Yeah. It's worth noting that only for the boss, the advantages you spend on the combat cards are persistent, meaning that between like encounters with the boss or attempts at the boss, anytime you like lower the effectiveness of a card, it remains lowered. So if somebody summons the boss, technically you can probably prepare for a turn or two where a different player will use advantages and then run away after like the first or second card. Just to make it easier for the next player. That's one of the like main ways you can sort of multiply the effectiveness of your advantages.
Right. The last thing, this isn't a strategy point, but it should be mentioned, because we've talked about a couple of the ways that you lose the game. Obviously, you win the game when you defeat the boss. But there's one way that you lose the game that we haven't mentioned yet, and that is when a player would acquire a third corruption. So, like we mentioned, you acquire corruptions when your buildings get destroyed in your kingdom. You also acquire a corruption whenever you're forced to spend a resource or lose a resource and you can't pay it in full. So, like, if I have three warriors and I'm fighting a monster and the monster tells me to lose six warriors, obviously I don't have six warriors. If I have no way of paying that, I lose, you know, whatever warriors I do have. And then I take a corruption because I was not able to complete that action. And if it's in the middle of combat, you still have to finish the combat. So it's possible that I could take multiple corruption from one combat. Taking two corruption is bad, because that means if you gain one more corruption, everybody loses. So just be aware of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the end of our strategy portion. We're going to take a quick break to talk about some promotional messaging that we have for ourselves. And then at the end of that, we are going to talk about the design of the game. What did we call it? The plug phase? Plug phase. Yeah, I still like that. I keep forgetting what it's called, and I'm always pleasantly reminded of it. So we're entering the plug phase. We'll see you on the other side, or we'll see you there. And then we'll see you on the other side to talk about design.
There's three sides.
Yes. See you on both other sides. All right. Here we are in the plug phase. It feels nice to be back here again. And as always, I'll begin the plug phase by saying you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast to get updates on when we're going to post new episodes, maybe see little teasers about what those episodes might be about. You can hit us up with suggestions for topics to discuss on the social platforms. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged. You can use our search bar function to find an episode. You could even use that function to find our interview with Rob Davio. Also on our website, there's an email form where you can hit us up with suggestions for games, and also if you're trying to get your own game promoted, we would love to chat about that, maybe discuss it in a future episode. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/users/BGBcast, where we have merch with our cool logo and branding on it. It's very awesome. Go check it out. That does it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream during weekdays. Time has been kind of up in the air recently due to current sort of personal events. But you can catch me there playing a lot of roguelites, a lot of competitive games. I think pretty soon I'll be starting up a playthrough of Majora's Mask, since that's on the Switch now. So if any of that sounds cool, check that out. Every Monday, or every first stream of the week, I do my weekly Shonen Jump Jump, which is me talking about the recent chapters from weekly Shonen Jump manga, a sort of review column. You can also check out my Twitter, at Matt Craig Gaming, where I post my takes and mini-reviews and other stuff like that. You can follow my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/IEatAtSonic, IEatAtSonic, where I'm starting to post more like video essays and analyses. And you can check out my other podcast, NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where me and my co-host Galen talk about sort of modern day media, things like movies, video games, TV shows, music, all with sort of a an edge towards like what is relevant to internet culture. And we just did an episode on the meme economy, which is sort of a critical lens to use to look at internet memes and internet meme culture. So if that sounds interesting, check out NetSurfer Pro.
Highly recommend it, NetSurfer Pro. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs, where I mostly just like things that make me laugh and also sometimes tweet about games or design. All right, that does it for plugs in the plug phase. So we will see you now on that third side while we discuss the design of Return to Dark Tower.
Okay, so I feel like one big thing to start off with is the app itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of an interesting point because I feel like there's sort of a split in the board game community over apps. I think some people see it as a sort of betrayal of what makes a board game. Like there's a sort of separation between board and video game, and it kind of, I don't know, kind of removes that or ignores that, almost takes away from what a board game is and turns it into a video game. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I think in this case, what Return to Dark Tower does is the app has sort of two main functions, one of which is to handle, like you said, decks of cards, like the combat cards, the quests, the dungeons. These are all things that you could automate via tabletop game systems, but it would take a lot of components and a lot of space. The other thing is it adds surprise, which is, I mean, it's something you can do in board games, but it's a lot harder to do sort of unexpected surprise, where, even in this game, I could look at sort of the box of minis and see, like, okay, there's, like, this big winged thing, or there's this weird-looking monster here. I wonder what kind of boss that is. But I feel like when I go into a game of Return to Dark Tower against a boss I've never fought before, I genuinely feel surprised at what that boss does. Because, for like, sure, I don't see it until it happens.
Yeah, it definitely adds, like, a veil of mystery to a lot of the aspects of this game. It's one of the reasons why, in our first game, combat was such a, like, a scary thing to encounter. Because, like, we knew, like, we needed to have some warriors. We didn't know really what else we were going to need. If there was a deck of cards, then you may have peeked at those cards, or we may have unwrapped those cards as we were opening the box and seen the kinds of things that combat does. So yeah, having the app adds that little bit of mystery to it, which there's like a little suspense to it. Like, what exactly does this monster do? And have I entered this combat with enough resources to take care of it?
Yeah. It's also worth noting, so the original Return to Dark Tower, or sorry, the original Dark Tower board game was a battery-operated game, where, you know, the tower was sort of like a roll of tape, that was pulled by motors, and, you know, you use batteries to play it. And I feel like
There was also a computer in there that, like, determined what was going on.
Yeah, but the display was tape. But what I wanted to say is that battery-powered games were, like, kind of a trend in, like, the 80s, early 90s, and it's not too far off from what an app game can do, to the point where there are other remakes of older battery-operated games, like Stop Thief, that use apps because it's essentially the same implementation, that this is a way to automate something that is traditionally done by, like, a GM. You know, a game master says, oh, you suddenly fight three orcs, or now the boss is going to pour lava down the water rivers. They're going to burn the rivers. But in this game, it's just a computer does it, so all players can be part of the player class, player character side.
Right.
I don't think, like, using apps is as much of a betrayal of board games, because it is just a modern implementation of something that has been around for like 40 years.
Yeah, it's definitely not that new. Like, it, a lot of things have existed in the past that are essentially apps when you break them down. Like the original Dark Tower board game, the tower had a computer in it, and the computer, you know, ran the combat between you and the monsters and told you like how many warriors you would lose. So that's not much different than what the app for Return to Dark Tower does. One thing that the app does that's very fun that integrates with the tower is that when an event happens at the end of a player's turn that would have them remove a door, or that would have the tower spin internally so that the skulls that were maybe behind one door get shifted so that they're now on an open space and can now fall out into someone's kingdom. That's all controlled by the app, and then the app communicates that to the tower via Bluetooth. The app also forces, like I think we mentioned, that it makes the tower light up on a specific door when you have to remove a door, or a seal, as they're called, in the game. So yeah, that's very excellent that the app sort of has these, like, mechanical or like physical manifestations. One of the other things that the app does is if you complete certain quests, it might have you gain a quest reward, which is like an item that comes from a special deck of cards that's set aside during the game setup. So yeah, so the app, it is an app, and it handles some things just purely in the digital space, but occasionally it has these moments where it does something physically on the board, which I think, like, reduces the feeling that you might not be playing a board game.
Yeah, it always feeds back into the board somehow.
Yes.
The last, like, main thing that I think is app only is the fact that the boss combat cards have persistent changes, where, like, the reductions in threat that you use advantages for, you know, persist over between turns. I do remember in the interview we did, Rob Davio had talked a bit about how that's sort of a design space that digital games can afford that is at least much harder for board games to do. You know, there are some games that have card changes like that, like Mystic Veil. But in this case, I think it's sort of a cool difference that makes the boss feel more like a collaborative effort to fight, and it also lets them make the boss a lot harder with a lot more cards while not feeling too unfair. So it does use the digital space in a unique way that is digital only, but at the same time it does so, I think, to pretty cool dramatic effect.
I think I want to revisit just that, like, there's a ton of pleasant surprises that happen with this game that are only possible because of the app. Because, like, if you were to say, like, okay, you acquire this ally and that's gonna add some special, like, positive events to the end of players' turns. If that was a deck, then you would say, like, okay, you acquire the ally, then you also acquire their special deck of events, and you shuffle those in with the basic events, like monsters attack or the tower rotates or whatever. And during the shuffling process, you might see what they do, or you might just be clued into that, like, the allies do things during the event phase. But with the first time we played, we didn't know exactly what it meant to have an ally, or rather we had an ally and was doing things, but it didn't click necessarily that these are, like, special events that are only happening because we have this ally. So, like, coming to that realization and then seeing what those events are and what they do was, like, a very pleasant surprise, in addition to seeing, like, the tower rotate for the first time and getting a quest reward for the first time. All very fun, pleasant surprises that are kind of only possible because the app sort of concealed them until they happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is also, I think, the fact that, like, one of my favorite moments in the game is whenever the tower spins or it rotates, that, like, shifts around the compartments and the seals and stuff, because it genuinely feels like you are just waiting for the app to kind of reveal its machinations to you. Like, I kind of love the implementation of waiting in a board game.
Mm-hmm.
Usually that's something that you don't really want in a board game. You want players to be active. But in this case, it is a lead up to the sudden shift in, effectiveness, what your actions can be, what your immediate problems are. And that's something that I think is not very common in board games.
Right. That suspense and drama, you know, maybe it usually comes from having to shuffle something before you draw a card, like shuffle a bunch of cards before you draw one randomly is like an example of that happening in a non-digital board game.
Right. Or rolling dice.
Right. That too. Yeah. Or maybe flicking a spinner. But yeah, definitely not to the same effect or with the same kinds of stakes that this game has to it.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention that the monsters are all really well balanced. I think that the level 4 monsters are especially well designed just because they're the things that they do are like the worst things that could happen in the game. So you definitely feel like a real sense of dread when they appear and urgency that they need to be taken care of because they could end the game if you don't do anything. But then also there's sometimes when you, cause usually a monster can only affect the things around it, like the buildings in the country that it's in or the players in the country that it's in. So sometimes like a big monster will spawn really soon and nobody will be able to deal with it. So you'll just like abandon that country for a little bit, which I think is kind of a funny little narrative thing that happens just based on the mechanical balance of the monsters in this game.
Yeah, there are times where you just have to be like, well, we can only do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
I love how tactile this game is. So, like, the tower obviously has great table presence. It is designed to be an imposing force. No doubt this has the same sort of philosophy as Fireball Island, where they had to kind of recreate the feeling that it gave rather than the actual physical specifications. The tower is high enough that sometimes I'd have to stand to put a skull in, depending on, like, what table I was at.
It kind of obscures, like, the other side of the board.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a fun thing.
Yeah, the fact that I'd have to, like, stand up and kind of walk around to view the other side, the fact that the tower is, like, physically in my way really helps sell it. But then, like, the skull tokens all feel really nice, I love moving everything around. I don't know. There's something about the feeling of this game. And the part of, like, kind of similarly to the aspect of waiting for it to spin, when it reveals a seal and you have to remove that seal, that's another sort of really fun, like, present opening feeling.
By the way, the design of the tower itself, like the construction and modeling and everything of the tower itself, is really excellent, and I wanted to mention, because they weren't mentioned as game designers, but lead tower developer Tim Burrell Saward did a really excellent job developing the tower itself as a component.
I think that going quickly back to the characters, I think the like differences between characters are pretty well done. I think when you get to a co-op game like this, usually you have like either the character does one thing different, which is sort of the Matt Leacock style, if you will, and then you have the Spirit Island of like every character plays completely differently with different priorities and weaknesses and strengths. I feel like this is a pretty good middle ground where everybody can do the same things. And a lot of times the actual advantages they have don't really come across until later when you start unlocking virtues. Like, even though we said the Orphan Scion is the worst, it's really just because it doesn't do like a whole lot at the highest rate that the other characters do, but it can still do everything else in the game.
Right.
It can still fight and take actions and stuff. And I think for a co-op game, it's pretty nice that like the main difference between them is just what resources they grant. Because like, you know, the Relic Hunter gets a potion, the Orphan Scion gets a spirit, the Warlord gets fighters, but they can trade those, which I think sort of promotes that cooperative gameplay. There's enough of a difference that it doesn't get too quarterbacked, but there's also enough similarities that you're flexible. It's pretty well done.
I wanted to also, you made me think that maybe the tower blocking your view of the other side of the board also kind of prevents quarterbacking.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't really have a holistic view of what needs to be done on any given turn.
Yeah.
You can't see the whole board.
Your own kingdom is definitely easier to see since it's, you know, pointing towards you.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up a couple things. First of all, I think you mentioned miniatures, which was one of the bonuses I got.
Oh, for okay.
That I backed the game at. Technically, monsters are just little like tokens that lay flat on the board in the base game, but the miniatures are incredible to this game. So I highly recommend them for anybody who's looking to purchase this and considering whether or not to get the miniatures. I know they can be kind of gimmicky or whatever, but in this game, they really add to like just how dangerous some of the monsters are. Like the dragon is massive with its sculpt. They're all really well detailed. It also helps because the quest markers, which tell you where you need to go on the board to perform certain quests, they also get their own miniatures in that expansion material, and they are very helpful for marking things off. So yeah, highly recommend the miniatures. And then I also received an expansion that added new characters as well as guilds, I believe. I think they're called guilds. And the guilds are really interesting. They add like a special progression to each kingdom, and you need to visit a guild hall in that kingdom in order to like do the progress for that guild. And the guild hall is, you know, there's four guilds, and each guild hall is one of the four types of buildings. And you put a little flag on that building in your kingdom to show that's the guild hall. Super cool. And they start out the game by giving you penalties. And so you need to like gain their favor at the beginning of the game to actually start to get bonuses from them. And the ultimate bonus is to get a fully fledged ally from them. And then it adds two new player classes, which are both kind of interesting. One of them puts reinforcements on the board. The other one is like extra good at removing skulls. It also adds skulls of different colors. So the skulls can have bonus effects when they are on buildings. So that all is super interesting. We haven't had a chance to play with it yet, but I'm very excited to try it out because I think it's going to add even more interesting dimensions to the game, making it like a little bit more difficult. Also, the app has a advanced difficulty to it. Also, there's a competitive version to this game that we haven't played. So
yeah,
there's still tons of content that we haven't explored. We've gotten really good at beating the base game, but there's so much more to experience and so many more places to go from there. And we still haven't fought every boss too. So one good thing about the design of this game is there's tons of replayability. If that's your thing, there's tons of like different scenarios to go through and monsters to fight and ways to increase the difficulty.
I wanted to mention two more things before we end this episode. One of them is that I really love the buildings, the Citadel, Sanctuary, Village, and Bazaar. Each one has a different shape. Sort of at least slightly different. There's like a circle, an oval, a clover, and a triangle. And they are sort of constructed like bowls to where, you know, when you put a skull on the building, it kind of stays in there. However, they do also look like a castle sort of setting with ramparts. So that's a pretty smart use of theme to create a component that fits with the mechanics. It's a triple win. But also, they're like just enough size to hold 3 or 4 skulls. So that's another usage of the components and mechanics working in unison. Really, really fun little bit. Then also, I wanted to mention... this last part is just kind of an anecdote, but I wanted to go back to the idea of, like, the personal narrative. You mentioned, like, how when we would get an early super strong monster, there'd be a bit of a narrative to it, like a little story. I noticed in our first game, we focused a lot on our own kingdoms, when really the game is about ignoring the differences between kingdoms. Like... kingdoms are your health, sort of, with the skulls, but otherwise you can freely move through them. And I feel like that's sort of a really interesting, like, sort of experience is, like, wait a minute, we are actually cooperative working together with this. We don't have to focus on our own thing. You know, you can clear other people's skulls, so in a way, it doesn't even really matter that, like, the buildings are your own buildings getting skulls. You don't want skulls on any buildings to an extent.
Right.
And so I think there's this really fun little, the first time we played it, we had that narrative of like coming together and realizing that the best way to play was to like move all the way around and ignore any sense of borders.
Yeah. And when you're specializing, that also leads to this because like an objective will pop up in some person's kingdom, but another player is better at solving that problem than that player. So yeah, you start to just move around and go wherever you're needed rather than just sticking to your own area and just clearing a bunch of skulls.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with all that being said, that will conclude our episode on Return to Dark Tower.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. We recently, there was a board game convention in town and we played a bunch of cool board games and acquired some of them. So look forward to future episodes over the coming months discussing all these cool new games. Until then, we'll see you next time.
See ya.